Good morning. It is very good to see you all. We're, as far as I can figure out, we stopped at Exodus 10, verse 20, at the end of the eighth plague, which brings us to the ninth plague and then the tenth, the last two. These two are the ones that probably relate the most directly to the Passion story and into Holy Week. And so we'll touch on that just a little bit. But we move right away here into the plague of darkness. Exodus 10:21. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand toward the sky so that darkness will spread over Egypt. Darkness that can be felt." What a sentence that is. Mashash is the Hebrew word for, it's very rare in the Bible, but it means to grope or to be able to feel something in some way. And I searched for it, and the only other place I can find it, it might be in other places, but there's a good example in Genesis 27. Blind Isaac is being deceived by Jacob and Esau. And Isaac is, you have to close your eyes to do it. He's groping, you know, trying to feel, and he ends up feeling what? The arms of Jacob, because Rebecca put goat hair on his arm and so forth, and he's kind of groping around like that. So I didn't look in the Proverbs. There might be a grope or a feel kind of a word in the Proverbs, something like that. I could look at that. But there was nothing in the margin of the Hebrew text to help me out with that. But mashash is to do that. And I thought about asking the question, maybe you can define it for me. What is darkness? Light. Absence of light. Yeah, it also means, because we all maybe get up in the night and your house is dark, but you can still kind of see. But in true darkness, there's the absence of any light at all. In our houses, there's maybe outside light, or maybe you have a night light or something. Or those two beady little things on the floor are the cat's eyes reflecting some kind of light back at you. But there's nothing to reflect light at all. There's an absence of anything that might diminish the darkness. True darkness like this is so completely black that we're gonna feel or be told that they couldn't see anything at all. They couldn't see their hands in front of their faces. They couldn't see each other. Can you imagine if it just suddenly became, boom, that dark, and we were all here, and it lasts for 3 days, and you think to yourself, what's the biggest danger of in this room if the world suddenly became dark, even just for one day? Biggest danger? That stairway. Just 10 feet out this door is a stairway going down. And then running into a plate glass door. But light reveals what darkness conceals. What does this talk take us into in our minds? Light and dark. It's creation. Yeah, God suddenly, for the Egyptians, undoes creation for a moment. Remember who I am. Remember who you're dealing with. I'm not one of your rinky-dink Egyptian made-up gods. I'm the God who made light in the first place. And I can take it away if I want to. And in fact, light that shows the way, this was a darkness that obliterates the way. They would have no way of knowing anything. And in our application of this, this can be seen as a type of hell, a total separation from light, from joy, from rest, from happiness, to be in that kind of darkness, deprivation of natural light, but also a blindness of the mind. You can't think straight. A perversity of the will. You can't reason properly. It's the sending of calamities and inflictions and miseries of every kind. Did it come to your mind as well as mine? Darkness for 3 days. Where do I go to the bathroom? Exactly. Where do I go to the bathroom? And it also brings on contempt and disgrace and so many other things. And even beyond those basic things, what if I, in a world where everything is all about cleanness and uncleanness, how do I cleanse myself? How do I get home? How do I know my children are okay? Why did that come into my head? Ladybug, ladybug, fly away home. Your house is on fire, your children are gone, right? So my grandmother used to say when we get a ladybug. Then she'd blow them away, whatever. Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky. Total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or leave his place for 3 days. Yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Can you imagine living next door to an Egyptian and you're an Israelite? You can see and he can't? How is that possible? Because this is an absolute miracle. This is not a manipulation of nature. It is not an eclipse. Okay, an eclipse does bring darkness, but you can take care of an eclipse if you just have a lamp or a flashlight or fire or a match. Or as my childhood doctor would say, or my cigar. Did your childhood doctor smoke in front of you while you were at the doctor also? Mine did. Anyway, let's go beyond that. An eclipse lasts only a matter of minutes. There was an eclipse about 10 years before this in southern Egypt. There was a much darker eclipse about 15 years after this, also in southern Egypt, but not here, not in this part of Egypt. The mathematicians who work at NASA do wonderful things with doing backwards eclipse mathematics by judging where the orbits of things go and where would an eclipse be. So you can, if an eclipse gets mentioned in an ancient document, they can tell you what day it was. It's a wonderful tool, but nothing lines up with Passover, 1446 BC. It's 10 years one way and 15 years the other way, and it's in the wrong part of the country. So both the eclipses I'm talking about were down south in southern or northern or southern or upper Egypt. And I have a note about that for you in your notes. But this darkness lasted 3 days, not 3 minutes, and it could be felt. This was God's withdrawing light from Pharaoh's land. And then how would you eat in that kind of darkness? It was a foretaste of hell, what it was, for 3 days. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and said, "Go worship the Lord. Even your women and children may go with you. Only leave your flocks and herds behind." So Pharaoh gives in, but not quite. And Moses has something to say about this. Moses said, "You must allow us to have sacrifices and burnt offerings to present to the Lord our God. Our livestock, too, must go with us. Not a hoof is to be left behind." Isn't that a great sentence? Not a hoof. "We have to use some of them in worshiping the Lord our God, and until we get there, we will not know what we are to use to worship the Lord." Which also meant not only the animals, but what utensils they would use. And anything else, water, food, wine, really even their tents, their camps, they had to take everything. That was Moses' stipulation. We got to take everything. And if it's on a hoof, it's got to come with us. So everything is going to come. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Pharaoh said to Moses, "Get out of my sight. Make sure you do not appear before me again. The day you see my face, you will die." So he withdraws his shallow offer to let them go. And this is obviously after the darkness has left. Moses and Pharaoh can see each other when Pharaoh says this. So the darkness was there 3 days. Then the darkness lifts. Pharaoh says, "Go," but Moses says, "We got to all go or no." And Pharaoh rescinds his offer. But Pharaoh's statement here, "The day you see my face, you will die." Moses replies, "Just as you say, I will never appear before you again." So Moses here leaves everything in the Lord's hands. We see this in Luke 17. Noah preached right up until the Lord commanded him to go into the ark. We're told elsewhere that Noah was preaching and preaching. The building of the ark itself was a sermon to the people. There's a terrible disaster coming. Watch out. The waters are coming. And he was also preaching actual sermons, and right up until he got into the ark, he was preaching, but then he got into the ark, God closed the door, and the rain was coming. So it was too late. And then Jesus says it in Luke 17. Some of our church fathers repeat that, and I have to agree with it. You don't get it from Genesis directly, but from Hebrews as well. But Lot was doing it too in Sodom. Lot was cringing and what was going on around him in Sodom, and he was preaching in his way, whatever way that was. So Jesus says it was the same in the days of Lot. People were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But the day Lot left Sodom, fire and sulfur rained down from heaven and destroyed them all. So as soon as the preaching is taken away, then the disaster comes. And now this is what happens with Moses and Pharaoh in Egypt. Moses is preaching the sermon. It's largely a law sermon, but there's also been some gospel. But then Pharaoh says, stop it. And Moses says, okay, this is the hand of God. You will not see me again. I'm done. But this is still going to happen. Anything on chapter 10? Did you hear the question? It was about why hadn't Moses been executed? But I will say this, that aspect of the fourth commandment is something to remember, that when justice is due, if it's put off, it leaves a hole, doesn't it? And we wonder, why wasn't justice done here? So the scripture is very clear about justice. If it should be done, it should be done. Do it and move on. Don't delay it either. That's also in Proverbs. All right, chapter 11, very short chapter here. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. So God has foreseen that Pharaoh will not let the people go as Moses had demanded, but he will in fact not let the people go. Pharaoh's going to drive them out. Pharaoh's going to do the opposite. He's not going to let them remain in Egypt when the time comes. And Paul, with regard to turning away from Pharaoh, Paul also said to Titus, give a divisive person one warning and then maybe warn them a second time. And after that, have nothing else to do with them. Have you heard that passage in Titus? That also applies here with Pharaoh. Moses warned him and warned him and warned him. And then when the time came, okay, the warnings are at an end. And it was Pharaoh himself who ended the warnings. So this is God still speaking. Tell the people that men and women alike are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold. That is after the final plague. So after the, and what let's clear up the details here. What's the final plague, the 10th plague? The death of the firstborn. We're going to be told every household was affected by the death of the firstborn. If you were a firstborn son, didn't matter how old you are, how young you are, or if you had feet or hooves, every animal, every human, firstborn was going to die. And so God tells us every household in Egypt was affected by this. And it's after that that the Israelites, men and women alike, are to go into these houses and say, can you give us some silver and gold? We're taking a trip. And they did. And we'll hear more about the why here in the next verse. But after the plague, ask the neighbors for articles. Why does God want them to, as we're told later on, plunder the Egyptians this way? What's the gold for? It's to build the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle. That's what they were going to use, is this plundered Egyptian gold to build all of the things. God's going to send them out into the desert and say, build. And there are people who read the Bible a little bit too lightly will sometimes ask, well, where'd they get the gold? Well, they plundered the Egyptians on the way out there. That's just eight chapters away when the commandments are given and then the directions for building the tabernacle, all of these posts, and the yarn to make the fabric to hang these giant curtains and the rings and the clever way they had of fashioning these things, even the hinges on the doors within the holy place and so forth, all of it comes from this plundered gold and silver. In fact, when the Israelites started bringing the plunder to Moses, at some point Aaron said, we have enough, tell them to stop. And so they had to stop bringing all of their plundered gold and silver at that point. Do you know, during World War II, do you know what the Blitz was, specifically in Britain? It was when the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, was attacking London and bombing and a little bit of strafing, but mainly bombing and so forth, and they were really being attacked. And somebody in the war cabinet had the idea, told Churchill about this. Let's have the people bring their aluminum pots and pans and tell them we're going to build Spitfires and Messerschmitts. We're going to build planes out of this stuff. You can't build an airplane out of somebody's old cooking pan, you know. But it was great for morale, and people began thinking that they were part of the war effort by making do with their old cast iron stuff and giving up their new aluminum stuff. And then after the war, they wondered, what do we do with all these warehouses full of unused pots and pans? You know what they did? Nothing. They're still there. They didn't have the heart to, you know, what do we do? They found out in the late 50s or 60s, and then by that time, nobody knew what was theirs. They just, well, whatever. So I don't know if it went into yard sales or what. But in that moment, it was great for the morale of the people. Let's all pitch in. And that's what God had in mind, plundering the Egyptians and then having the people throw in all of their gold and silver to build this stuff. You've become rich. Now give out of your wealth. If I'm going to ask you for a lot, I'm going to give you a lot first. It's going to happen. The Lord, verse 3, yeah. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people. In Hebrew, caused the Egyptians to be favorably disposed toward the people. And Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people. He had kavod, he had weight. He had, when anybody in Egypt, except Pharaoh apparently, thought of Moses, they had the highest regard for this man. Everybody thought a lot of Moses, except, of course, Pharaoh. Pharaoh's heart was in one place, but all of his people were in another with regard to their feelings toward Pharaoh. There's one thing we passed over that was intended. How long did the darkness last? 3 days. And then God brought his people out of bondage. So we also have that reflected in the burial of Jesus for 3 days. And then God's people was brought out of bondage. And even if you want to carry that a little bit further, hadn't the victory over the grave and certainly over sin and the devil happened already on the cross? And you could even make that argument if you want to, because the Israelites already had light. Those who were believers could see during the darkness, the 3 days of darkness. But then the whole world saw after that with the resurrection and so forth. Would you like an Exodus 11 sermon on Easter Sunday morning someday? Am I up this year? I'm not sure. I think I am. Verse 4. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says, about midnight, I will go throughout Egypt. Now, who does the Lord say is going to go? He himself. I will go. There is sometimes a question about who went. I have a deceiving sentence in your notes. We are not told whether there was a disease like the plague or a killing angel. Actually, the Psalms says it was a killing angel, a destroying band of angels, in fact. But we'll leave exactly what form that could have taken. It could have been some fast-moving plague, but probably just the killing angels of the Lord. How does it, in the I've only watched one movie about the Exodus, and that's the Charlton Heston movie. And there it's a blue smoke or a green smoke going through the streets about ankle high. Have you seen any other representations of what this was? Usually in pictures, it's an angel with a sword. So it happens without warning. It happens to man and animal. Doesn't affect any of the Hebrews. We could say that is those Hebrews that painted the blood on the door frames, but I think we can say that I think all of the Hebrews would have painted blood on the door frames. Even the grumbly ones survived. Korah, Dathan, Abiram, those guys who are going to die later on, they survived the Passover. So unless their older brothers died, I think that we can say that they did it. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die. From the firstborn son of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, to the firstborn son of the slave girl, who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. So from the greatest to the least in the land, and the animals too. If you're curious, the Pharaoh, I think was Pharaoh at this time, Thutmose III, was about the fifth son and not the firstborn son of his father. So there were other men who were ahead of him in line. But 80 years before this, if we're worried that this is a severe punishment of God, what had Egypt done when Moses was a baby? They had killed all the firstborn sons. Well, no, all the sons. All the baby boys, period. And the order was not just given, to the firstborn. The Pharaoh at that time said, every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile. So now the same thing was going to happen with Egypt, but only with the firstborn. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. Wailing. It has been said often enough, and probably doesn't need to be repeated, the death of a child is the one thing that no one should ever have to undergo. Whether we all expect our parents to die before us, and half of us know that our spouses will die before us, but to lose a child. And every household was affected by this. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any man or animal. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. Why does that expression get used? Well, we just talked about wailing. So in the Israelite houses, no wailing, no crying, no noise, not even a dog barking, nothing, because there's no sadness, no grief among the Israelites. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction. All these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me and saying, go, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave, Moses says. Then Moses, his nose hot, left Pharaoh. Isn't that a delightful expression in Hebrew? When you're really, really angry, your nose gets hot. Do you remember the Bugs Bunny episode where he is a matador and he's fighting a bull and he's like, stop messing up my tail. He's breathing on him. That's what I think of. And I should have gotten a meme with that on it for you. Or is it possible that Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh? Moses had said he would not do this, but then Pharaoh came to him. You know, Moses said, I'm not going to come back. But then Pharaoh found him. The Lord had said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. There's a word, it's rav or ravav. It's to be big in Hebrew. And that's what the Lord says here about his wonders. They will be bigified, isn't a word, is it? Enlarged, I suppose, would be the English way of speaking. We don't always speak English in my house. But enlarged or multiplied or made famous or all of the above. So things are going to get even bigger than this, God says to Moses. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of his country. So God, in a sense, shuts the door on the Israelites and locks it so that they can't get out now. There's no way out of Egypt now. Pharaoh refuses everything. You're not going. My heart is hard. And Pharaoh virtually says that he's going to throw away the key. The Israelites are staying no matter what. And the Lord has orchestrated things and hardened Pharaoh's heart so that this would be the state of affairs. So that when, just hours later, Pharaoh tells them, get out, it will glorify God all that much more. Where we go from you're never leaving to I never want to see any of you ever again is just spectacular. However, something else has to happen. And did I say hours? Well, now the text jumps around and starts throwing days at us. It's now the 10th of Nisan. We're at chapter 12. Why? By the way, in all of Exodus, there are two chapters that should jump out at us. 20 because that's the Ten Commandments, and 12 because that's Passover. If you like to remember certain things as being in whatever chapter of the Bible, later after your study of Exodus, if you could remember really that chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments, that would be a great victory. But if you also want to remember one other chapter, it would be that chapter 12 here is the Passover. And I wasn't sure we would get this far. I'm surprised we got as far as we did, as quickly as we did. So I don't have any pictures, nor did I bring along any roast lamb or anything else like that for us to look at. But we'll see what happens next week. Chapter 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year." It's in early spring, and now God says, change your calendar. What had they been using up to this point? Well, I looked that up. This month in Egypt was called Pakons, the month of the early harvest. The spring equinox was celebrated on about the 6th of Pakons, that's March 21st. The Egyptian calendar was pretty stable throughout the long history of ancient Egypt. And on the 20th of Pakons, about April 4th, there was a festival observed by the Egyptian priests and magicians who believed that on that day, each year, the goddess Maat brought the souls of the dead before the other gods for judgment. And so, but it wasn't the beginning of the year. That was in July in Egypt. So the Egyptians were following a July to July calendar, which is a little bit like our fiscal year. So whatever calendar Israel had been using up to this moment, which I'm guessing was probably the Egyptian calendar, you know, something like that, this month in early springtime was now going to be the first month of their year. They called it Abib, which means ears of grain for the early harvest. And later on, they renamed it Nisan, which was the Babylonian word after the Jews came out of the exile. We don't have the names of all of the Israelite months in the Bible. We have, I think, 8 of them that are mentioned in Scripture here and there. The festival months and a couple of other months, usually the month after a festival we find out. But there are a couple of outliers that we just don't have mentioned. If somebody were someday to collect all of your letters and emails, would you be shocked to find out that you had never mentioned November or June, you know, yourself, that you never wrote those words out? That's all it is. It's just a case of that. But in the back of your Bible, if you have like a study Bible or one with notes, that probably has a calendar in it or something like that, you will see the Hebrew names for all 12 months. And the question sometimes is given, how do we get these? Where do they come from? They come from one of my favorite archaeological stories. A little boy lost his homework. It's true. There was a boy in the Philistine city of Gezer. The Philistines, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Israelites, and one other group, I'm forgetting who they were, all spoke the same basic Semitic language. They were all variations on Phoenician. Oh, the people of Tyre and Sidon. That's the last group. Variations of Phoenician. It's called Northwest Semitic. It is quite possible that the book of Job is written in a dialect of Northwest Semitic and not of Hebrew. When you're translating and reading Job in Hebrew, you have a lot of wrinkles in your forehead develop, and you're in your dictionary a lot because there's a lot of words that are, that's not the usual word. It's sometimes used, but it's not the usual word for this and that and east and west and north and what's going on and to go, to come. The word which or that is different. It should be a share, but it's kol kaveldi, that kind of thing. That happens in Aramaic also. And so Job is like that. Job may reflect the language of the actual man, Job. This little boy's Philistine calendar near the city of Gezer has two lists of the same little kind of poem or bumpity-bumpity rhyme about what happens in what month. This month is this harvest, this month is gathering, this month is collecting, this month is for pressing the grapes and things like that, on down to the calendar. The The teacher obviously wrote it at the top of the clay tablet, which is the size of your cell phone, by the way. That's how big this clay tablet is. So the top half is the teacher, and the bottom half is the child copying it. And he, of course, even though it's from here to here, he spells words wrong, just as you would expect, right? Even a backwards letter or two, just as you might expect from a child. So we know he's a little boy, but he's learning how to do it with this little clay stylus. And but it's out in the weeds, so he lost it on the way home. And it just baked in the sun, and then somebody found it. It's called the Geezer Calendar, a remarkable little piece of archaeology. I made my own version of it a few years ago out of styrofoam. Is it ever hard to press cuneiform letters into styrofoam and make the, I should have done it out of clay, but maybe I will someday. Or wax, that would work too. Anyway, but I have my own fake. It could never be mistaken by anyone for the real thing. So I think I'm safe. I'm not deceiving anybody with my little fake Geezer calendar. But that's where we get all those other month names from. That was a long path for a short anecdote, wasn't it? Let's go back to our text. Okay. So, change your calendar, God says. This month, this here month you're in now, this is the first month of your year from now on. Whatever they were using before, it changes on this date. Tell the whole community of Israel, oh, and how do they know when to start the month? When did all the months start? The new moon. When the moon is dark, the month starts. So there's no question about when the month starts. In fact, they knew what day it was. Even though the Lord said, this is your new month, it wasn't from that day, it was from that month. So tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. And if any household is too small for a whole lamb, what were they going to do with it? Eat it. Yeah. So what does this compare with, especially in our culture? I think Thanksgiving turkey, probably. We got too many for this size turkey. We don't have enough turkey for all the people who are coming. That kind of thing. So that's how they talked. Oh, we have a lamb. Maybe we need a bigger lamb. Maybe we need two lambs. You know, maybe you guys should have your own lamb. And yeah, they probably had a card table for the kids. Oh, I'm going to sit at the kid table again. In my dad's house, I'm still in my 50s. In my father's house, I still have to sit at the card table. Okay. All right. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. Obviously, they're going to eat this lamb. And not only the lamb, but what else? All of the fixings. This is going to be a meal. Wine, water, bread, which is coming up, but then everything else. What are you going to eat with the internet? You don't just have meat. Well, in my house, we sometimes do. Called it a caveman meal. Veggies. Yeah, all your veggies and all that kind of stuff. Your onions, your celery, your whatever it's going to be, that, and your fruit, whatever that's going to be. So let's have enough. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. So it didn't have to be a sheep. It could be a kid, a baby goat. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. So on the 10th, choose it. And then what did they do with it to make sure that it didn't, you know, that they had the right one? They tied it to their door or their tent. So they would keep it on a leash. And that's the one. And why wait 3 days? To make sure there's nothing wrong with it. It's not sick. It's not blind. It has all of its limbs. That's what a whole lamb. It wasn't about, does it have a perfect a hide with no spots or anything like that. It was just about, can it walk? Can it bleat? Is it blind? How do you know if it's blind? See if it jumps when you, or that's deaf. But, you know, move around, see if it looks at you and so forth. You know it's a whole, healthy animal. And then slaughter them at twilight. What was happening on the 14th of Nisan at twilight during Holy Week? They were inspecting their lambs and slaughtering them, and Jesus was led out to be crucified. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs, corresponding somewhat to the blood on the cross. So his blood was on that door frame, if you will, where they eat the lambs. Then that same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. The thing that confuses us a little bit in our analysis is, what's the difference between the Passover Jesus ate and his crucifixion as far as day of the week? To the Jews, all of that happened on the same day. Because when does Passover start? When does a day start to a Jew?
Sundown.
So the Passover meal was eaten just after sundown. We call it Thursday, but it was Friday to the Jews. And Jesus will be dead before that day is over. Get it? So before sundown on what we call Friday, Jesus will have died. But he is eating his Passover that same day. So that's all part of the same day. So our terms for Maundy Thursday and Good Friday are somewhat confusing, but it's all the same day for Jesus and the disciples. It was the day of the Passover. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Bitter herbs, in this case, the Jews traditionally choose my favorite bitter herb, the only one I like, celery. Not the bitterest of bitter herbs, right? In fact, those of you who know about calories and so forth, what's the great thing about celery? It has negative calories. It takes more calories to eat it than it gives you. Do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water. They couldn't have boiled meat. But roast it over the fire, head, legs, and inner parts. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. So roast it and then eat it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt. Can you tell me why? So they wouldn't trip. Yeah, they're ready to go. They had girded their loins, so they're ready to go. The part of the church service I struggle with the most, standing up after the children's devotion, because I step on my gown. You know, you can usually see me doing something very awkward at that moment. I'm glad you sing, because I'm about to fall over on the steps. So, and then your sandals on your feet. Eat with your shoes on and your staff in your hand. Be so ready that you are really, really ready to go. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. How many of you eat your meals with your shoes on? Everyone's afraid. We take our shoes off at our house, Pastor. Well, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn. Again, God says, I, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. So diminishing the gods of Egypt as well. There's nothing they can do to stop this. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. The word Passover is in Hebrew Pasach. So Pesach is often the word you'll see. I think it's probably spelled P-E-S-A-C-H, Pesach, if you use English letters, but that's usually the Jewish word for Passover, the Pesach. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. So there's gospel there. Law and gospel in the same verse, right? I'm going to touch Egypt. I'm going to strike Egypt, and I'm not going to touch you at all. This day, you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. Until when? Until Jesus institutes the new meal. Until Good Friday, or Maundy Thursday night. Yeah. So, for 7 days, You are to eat bread made without yeast. This begins on Passover itself, then goes for 7 days afterwards. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses, for whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day to the seventh must be cut off from Israel. There's a question here about how small a piece of yeast is a piece of yeast left over, and it's actually bigger than you and I would think. So a crumb of yeast that's bigger than like a coriander seed is what they're talking about. I think of BBs when I think of coriander seeds. They're about, you know, that they're fairly big. Anything smaller than that doesn't count, basically. So they had to sweep out pretty good. And obviously, if you have something less than that, you're not going to use that as your culture or something, you know, to make more yeast later on. But sweep it out pretty good. And I think if you're using hyssop as your broom, as well as your paintbrush and your comb, I think that's pretty reasonable of the Lord, you know. But not like, I mean, what would we do? We would, you know, vacuum and use, you know, a dustpan. We'd wipe it out again and then use a wet wipe and make it perfect. But even perfect in our sight, is that perfect in God's sight? No. So God gives them a reasonable amount of sweeping to do. You know, get it down to about this big, and that's what I want. But just don't eat the yeast. On the first day, hold a sacred assembly. That's Passover. And another one on the seventh day, so a week later, to us, 6 days later. Do not work at all on those days except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. So do nothing, do no labor. And to reflect what? Well, how much work did the Israelites have to do to get out of Egypt? None. Their neighbors brought them stuff, then they loaded up the truck, then they moved to, never mind. But all they did was walk out. How much difficult swimming did they have to do to get to the Red Sea? None at all. If they were sweating, it was because they were nervous. It was not because they were working hard to get out of Egypt. It was just go away, and they went. Celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because it was on this very day that I brought your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. The word God uses here for divisions is a military term. So by your hosts, by your armies, divisions. Why? Because they were going out to conquer Canaan. So God is already looking ahead to the next move. You're going to leave Egypt. You're going to leave Egypt peacefully, but you're not going to enter Canaan peacefully. We're going to be told here in the text in this very chapter that they had 600,000 men who were of military age, which gives us a total number of about 2 million Israelites. If you do the math there, probably more. At the very least, 2 million, maybe more. We'll pick it up there, chapter 12, verse 18, next time. Until then, God bless you all. Thanks for letting me do this. You've been listening to Invisible Church, the Bible study podcast from St. Paul's Lutheran Church, New Ulm, Minnesota.